Welcome. My name is Tash Frangross. I'm managing partner of Hayes McIntyre. And this is a podcast that we're running as part of our triple bottom line people, planet, profit series. So this is the second topic that we're exploring in the series, Green Horizons, Navigating Towards a Sustainable Future. We held a fantastic panel session. We had on that panel Dustin Benton, Policy Director at Green Alliance. We had Matthew Owen, Director at Call Earth, Bina Shah, CEO and co-founder at CCU International, and Peter Clark, Associate Editor and Business Columnist at the Financial Times. And I'm delighted to be continuing the conversation with Peter this afternoon. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Tash. Such a pleasure to be here.
So just if we sort of just pick up on some of the things that we spoke about, you referred to some research which found that actually the majority of the world's population wants to fight climate change, but that majority also thought that they were in a minority in thinking like that. So a bit of a misalignment there. Why do you think there is that misperception, and why is that an issue?
Well, it's a huge issue. And I think this research was a real shock to a lot of people. I've been covering this issue for years and years, and I was really, really surprised to see that this huge study, which was done by economists in Europe, and they interviewed 130,000 people in 125 countries, so that's most of the countries of the world, and they discovered that 69% of them would be willing, or at least said they would be willing, to give away 1% of their household income every month to fight global warming. That's a high number, but the really interesting point is that of those people, if you ask them how many other people they thought felt the same way, they thought that only 43% of people will have been willing to give away 1% of their income. So I think that speaks to a number of things, but overwhelmingly it speaks to this idea that for whatever reason, even though when we're talking with our friends, when we're talking at work, whenever talk turns to climate change, inevitably a lot of people are really concerned about it but feel really hopeless about it because they don't really get the same sense of concern, or they don't feel the same sense of concern emanating from governments, from their employers, even in a lot of the media coverage of climate change. There's just a sense that nothing can happen, and anyway, it's only a few select people who really worry about this. But actually, this survey is showing no, people are really broadly concerned.
But I guess the challenge with the kind of misperception is that, well, actually, yeah, I think it's a really important topic that I'm passionate about. But because I don't think anyone else thinks that, well, what's the point of me changing my habits and my behaviours to help the cause? Is that kind of, that's a risk, isn't it, essentially, that we then end up with no action?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, one of the economists that I spoke to who did this study, she said, she put it quite well. She said, why are you going to be the only idiot who doesn't go to Mallorca this year on a plane because you're worried about emissions? Yeah. And so people feel, well, why should I put myself out if everybody else doesn't really care? So you get this, that is the sort of the psychological condition, really, or the situation that we're dealing with. So I think this is a really powerful bit of research showing people that they should be, in fact, more demanding, and they shouldn't feel embarrassed or ashamed about saying that they're worried about this issue, because they're certainly not alone, and in fact, they're in the majority.
Mm. So it's almost like we need something to kind of empower that majority of people that want to do something about it, and to make them feel that their changes, their actions will make a difference. I wonder whether the media could help with making a wave of change. How can we affect a change in mindset, I guess?
I mean, I guess, some media organisations would say that, they try very hard to do this, and in fact, their coverage of climate change in general has expanded and has increased dramatically. And certainly that's the case, I think, in a lot of countries, the UK, the US, across Europe. I think there's no doubt that big media organizations like the BBC, for example, the New York Times, the Financial Times, we've all put on more bodies, essentially. We've basically got more people covering climate change. And in a way, everybody, even if they're not a dedicated climate change reporter at the Financial Times, because it's the sort of issue that touches almost every aspect of business life now, then everybody's become a climate reporter to some extent. Mm. I think the trouble is really, even though people are concerned and they tell pollsters they're concerned, there is still a legitimate question to be asked about how willing they really would be if the government decided to introduce a tax that amounted to 1% of their monthly household income. What would then happen? What other forces would come to bear? I think we can probably both of us imagine what might happen in this country, Tash, and in a lot of others, because, you know, you would find that there would be a lot of people saying this is absolutely outrage and why are we spending this on climate change? Wouldn't this be better to go to schools and hospitals? You know, how does this affect the whole levelling up agenda? You know, legitimate questions can be asked. I think always bear in mind that not everybody involved in the climate debate is, to use a sort of sociological term, a good actor. You know, there are always going to be interests who want to delay action, muddy the waters, cause confusion. And I think it's naive to pretend they don't exist.
And sort of related to that perhaps is, and we've touched on some other very influential groups that could affect change, being politicians, governments and businesses. And I know that some of the things we spoke about at the event last week was that actually the agenda there has changed somewhat, and there has been a little bit of a backpedaling on some of the green initiatives. What do you think the impact of that is, essentially, and how dangerous is that?
Well, I think, you know, if you step back a bit and look at the sort of long-term picture of where we've been on climate action and where we are now, we started off really globally going for the kind of low-hanging fruit, you know, going for things that were sort of relatively easy to do, although they didn't always seem like it at the time, like encouraging wind power, solar power, getting the electric car industry off the ground and so forth. And all of these things are, in a way, you know, they were good to do. They've made a big difference in some ways, but they weren't necessarily really biting or being felt by people in a very kind of severe or meaningful way. But now we're getting to the point in a country like the UK where, you know, most people wouldn't know that there's been a huge growth of renewables. And when they turn the lights on, you know, basically there's virtually no, well, there's very relatively little coal power is being used to keep the lights on in the UK now compared to what used to be the case. And there's a lot of wind and solar power, but people don't notice that, but they do notice it when the government says, oh, well, from 2030, or actually it's now later than that, you won't be able to buy a new petrol or diesel car. And also, if your gas boiler breaks down after a certain year, you're going to have to replace it with a heat pump. You know, people do notice these sorts of innovations and changes and shifts. And so you do have to be quite careful about governments and policymakers have to be quite careful about how they introduce these changes to make sure that the burden of the shift and the cost of the change doesn't fall unfairly on the shoulders of people who are least able to bear it. And I think that there have been a lot of people in the climate movement who've been very aware of this, but there's also, I think, been some that really haven't. And I think that merging those two agendas of sort of a social equity agenda with a climate agenda is really quite important to do. And some policymakers are doing that quite well, and others, I would say, are doing a less good job of it.
And do you think, when you talk about the low-hanging fruit, have we exhausted that, do you think, in your view? Have we gone for all that there is to go after there?
Well, probably not entirely, but I think in Western industrialized countries like the UK, it is, and across Europe actually, yes, it is getting much harder now, particularly when the goalposts have kind of shifted. Because that's the other thing, you know, when we started trying to cut emissions globally, scientists didn't quite understand exactly how urgent the mission was, in a sense. And it really wasn't until 2018 when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change brought out this report, this 1.5 degree report, showing that essentially you really needed to ideally halve emissions by 2030 and bring them down to net zero by 2050 if you're going to have a decent chance of stopping temperatures rising by 1.5 degrees from pre-industrial times. And all of that is just, you know, that's a lot of really complicated concepts that I just babbled off then, but really fundamentally what it means is that we should be cutting emissions now globally really, really quickly. And instead, they're still going up, not as quickly and not as fast as they used to. And in fact, there are some scientists who think that they might have actually peaked last year or will peak this year and then start to fall, which is going to be quite an interesting situation if it actually happens. But until now, this is the problem, that we should be bringing emissions down really, really quickly over the next 6 years, in fact, at an unprecedented rate. And we just haven't even got to square one as far as we can.
And the problem is huge because emissions are still rising. Things aren't moving in the right direction. And so therefore we read about the drastic action that we need to take, which is at the other end of the spectrum to make a difference, which for someone reading that is quite inaccessible. How can we put it in a way so that they think, okay, this is what I could do to make a difference and just increase the accessibility of the topic so that it feels that you can control the situation a bit more.
And, you know, how do you make people feel as though they've got some ability to make change and not to feel hopeless and therefore useless in the face of this gargantuan threat? I think it is a real problem. The only thing I would say is this, that, you know, none of us have ever lived in a world where emissions have been falling. All we know in our lived experience, all we've ever seen is emissions going up. Yeah. And actually, most of us have lived at a time when emissions have been shooting up at really, really fast rates. We have now reached a point where that's not happening at the speed that it was. And some scientists think that last year might have actually been the year when emissions did peak globally. And that this year, 2024, or maybe next year, depending on whether enormous emitters like China keep on keeping on with this incredible green energy boom that they've had for the last few years, if they continue with that, 2024 might be the year when emissions actually start to fall, and then they might fall again in 2025 and 2026. And I think it's really interesting for everybody to think about whether that changes the political weather, the corporate weather, the way that we think about the climate problem. Because if you can actually see that all of the climate action that's being taken is actually having an impact, personally, I'm inclined to think that that could have quite an interesting impact, and potentially, I don't want to over-egg this, but it might be quite transformative. If investors suddenly think, hang on, if demand for fossil fuels is really going down, then maybe I shouldn't be putting quite as much money into oil and gas and in some cases coal, because ultimately, or not even ultimately, in the very short term, that could be a bad bet. Maybe, just maybe, once that starts happening at a global level, it will have an impact. I think that's something to really keep a hold of and keep hoping that we see. And I think it's something that people don't think about probably enough. And why would they? Because, you know, it's never happened before and it may not happen for a year or two yet. But it's pretty encouraging to think sometimes about what might happen.
I think that's a very interesting point, isn't it? You know, if that was to happen, and even the fact that, you know, it's slowed, have we made enough of that? I don't know, but it's slowed and it could peak hopefully in the next year or so. Like you said, you could see a snowball effect, couldn't you, in terms of, like, you know, let's see. But that it would be very interesting to see what impact that tone from the top has then on the cascade and the ripple effect down.
Yeah, I think it's particularly interesting in the business world, to be honest, to think about this, because, you know, I'm sure you've had conversations like I have had with people in companies, and particularly in finance, who, it's not that they're climate deniers, but they just say, look, you know, you keep on telling me how bad this climate problem is going to be, and you keep on saying that we have to cut emissions, and then all of this, you know, countries are bringing in forms of carbon pricing and they're subsidizing green energy. And we've, you know, the US and the EU are ramping up green industrial policy. But, you know, really the truth is people still want fossil fuels. And fossil fuel companies, oil and gas companies, are trying to meet demands. So you might tell me that this is all terrible, but I'm telling you where the money's going. And the money is going into companies where then they know they're going to keep selling fossil fuels and giving investors a return that is far superior to what they might get with other investments. Now, that is the outlook that potentially changes if emissions start going down and people can start saying, well, you know, you might say demand is high and strong, but actually falling emissions suggest it's not as high as it might have been. I mean, it's not quite as simple as that, obviously, and there are always going to be people who are going to push back against this, and maybe I'm being far too Pollyanna-ish about it, but I still think it's something that we should think about more than we probably do at the moment.
I agree. It is very interesting for sure. You have recently written an article about the sort of doublethink, and I think that's corporates, isn't it, essentially? What do you mean by that concept, and why do you think it applies to certain areas of business?
So I would love to say that this was my original idea, but tragically it wasn't. It was actually an idea that was written about in a paper by Leo Strein, who used to be the top judge in Delaware, and Delaware's business courts, essentially, the main business courts in the US. So he is a massive fan of George Orwell and loves books like 1984 and Animal Farm, which essentially, obviously, are full of terms like doublethink, which, and doublethink is essentially where you know that what you're being told by, say, the government or the main political party of the time is wrong because your own knowledge of facts and your own experience and memories tells you that it's wrong. And yet because you're told that you have to say it's right, you actually go along with that. So you have to engage in this process of doublethink, of thinking something that you know is wrong is right. And so what Leo Strein, what he focused on was this whole anti-ESG, anti-woke capitalism debate in the US, where Republican politicians have been criticizing investors who have tried to take climate change into account in their investments and have basically said that they've got no business doing that because investors who are handling people's pension money shouldn't be bringing the politics into it. They should just be purely focused on getting the best return possible for their clients. So it sounds a reasonably plausible argument until you realize, as Strein points out, and as I wrote about in that column, that these same Republican politicians are perfectly happy to allow politics to come into it when it comes to things like their own corporate donations, for example. So he listed all of these companies that or situations where companies had donated, publicly listed companies, I might add, not even private ones, had basically allowed their political beliefs in, you know, whether it was guns, fossil fuels, whatever, to be used to back some of the same Republican politicians in their campaigns. So that, you know, that you could argue is just as big a diversion of money for political ends and therefore not necessarily great for shareholders. The other argument he pointed out was that, so these same politicians are saying that another problem with these so-called woke investors is that they're ganging up together into these climate and alliances, like these net zero groups that emerged in 2021. Their whole aim is to basically just get banks and insurers and asset managers together so that they can kind of work together on how best to take climate action. And so the Republicans are saying, well, this is just antitrust, this is anti-competitive behavior, and this can't possibly go on, and there's going to be lawsuits about this. And as Strein says, well, hang on, you know, we've had things like the American Petroleum Institute and various fossil fuel alliances that have been going in some cases for decades. And these same Republicans, astonishingly enough, didn't worry about the antitrust implications of that at all. So he was just saying, look, you know, if in order to believe in all of this anti-woke argument, you have to engage in massive doublethink. And I think that's right. I think, you know, we kind of often get ourselves into a situation where we just ignore this. We ignore the fact that politicians are basically saying black is white, and we're kind of going along with it. And so he's just
saying it suits the audience at the time. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The agenda at the time.
Yeah, yeah. And I think actually when you think about it, you know, I don't know about you, but when you look at groups like CDP, the Carbon Disclosure Project, as it was, that have been encouraging companies to disclose climate risk and their carbon footprints and whatnot for a long time, you kind of can think about that every company's doing this, but actually the number of companies who are doing it, tiny. It's a really small percentage of the total. And so You can sort of work yourself up into thinking about the world in a way that is completely white when it's black and vice versa. And it's always useful, I think, to just try to cut through that and look at what reality really is.
And arguably, the collaboration is actually very important on such a topic, isn't it? Like, because there is, it feels like, a knowledge and maybe education gap on some of these areas. It was interesting that we heard Bina talking about that last week, where she's, you know, going into these big corporates with big ESG teams, you know, and they're kind of saying, well, we think we need to plant more trees. And she's like, but it's much more than planting trees. And so clearly their collaboration is necessary to help move us forward on this, because that's when new ideas and innovation will come out. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, when you think about it, we've always had groups like the CBI in this country and Chambers of Commerce and other business groups that are interested, basically exist to help businesses to swap ideas and test new innovations and to understand exactly how others are going about tackling the same sorts of problems. And we've always had that in different sectors. Always, you know, these industry groups, I mean, and have always existed, whether it's farmers or steelmakers or bakers or butchers or whoever. So, yeah, there's nothing new about this. And when it comes to climate change, it's particularly important because, you know, you do, if you're a glassmaker and you're using a furnace that emits a lot of carbon dioxide, you would like perhaps to buy a new one that you've vaguely heard someone around the world somewhere is inventing and that can do it more cheaply. But doesn't it make sense to sort of work together with other glassmakers really to see actually which is the best one and iron out the problems and the kinks that you always get with new technology and basically just, you know, figure out a way to do this quickly. You know, there are obviously important reasons why anti-competition law or pro-competition law, I should say, competition law exists, but we shouldn't be letting that get in the way of the imperative to cut emissions. And I think, you know, a lot of governments now recognize that in this country and across in Europe and elsewhere. People have just said, well, of course, you know, we understand the problems with anti-competitive behaviour, but we also understand the imperative to cut emissions. So we're going to work through this. It's not rocket science.
Yeah. So we have a general election probably coming up in the UK. Do you think that's going to be important for this topic?
I do. Oddly enough, this is going to be the first election in this country since I arrived here in 2002, where climate is going to be, unfortunately, I think, quite a hot issue. In the past, we have seen the leaders of the major parties literally put out signed declarations that they're going to work together no matter what, no matter who wins, they'll all work together to advance climate action. And this country has a long history of bipartisanship when it comes to climate politics that is envied in a lot of countries, including the one that I was born in, Australia, because it just doesn't happen in every country. And unfortunately, we've seen not under Theresa May, not under Boris Johnson, Liz Truss didn't have enough time, but under Rishi Sunak, the current Conservative Prime Minister, we've seen this really quite interesting departure from the same level of bipartisanship, where he gave a speech last year essentially weakening net zero policies that were partly put in place because his predecessor, Theresa May, under her leadership, the UK became the first major economy to put net zero legislation into law, to put net zero targets into law. And so then, you know, she was followed by Boris Johnson, who was interrupted by the pandemic, but certainly agreed with the agenda. And then suddenly last September, Rishi Sunak gave a speech saying, oh, well, hang on, we don't really want to be going as fast on some of these net zero policies to do with electric cars, heat pumps, and other issues. You know, we're going to just rein things in a bit here, and we're not going to go as fast as we were. And I think that's caused a lot of confusion, and in some cases frustration on the part of green investors or investors in general, because they're now sort of thinking, oh, hang on, what's going on? Mm. The Labor Party, on the other hand, has been the beneficiary of that, really, because they're saying, well, look, okay, you know, we've had to roll back some of our expenditure, which was, I might add, really going to be quite enormous, our planned expenditure on green investment. It's not going to be as big. But fundamentally, we think climate change is a really big problem and we're going to do a lot of things differently to try to tackle it. So I think you've got a big difference now between the two main parties.
And is Rishi's stance linked to the point that you were saying earlier about some of those changes, making sure the burden of those changes doesn't fall unfairly on? So do you think it's linked to that or not?
That's certainly how he presented some of the changes. But I think the thing is that his predecessors understood the importance of not imposing a burden on low-income people in particular. And I guess, you know, to be fair to all governments, you know, they all have to grapple with this. They all know, as one European politician said many, many years ago, you know, this is a situation where we know exactly what to do. We just don't know how to get elected once we've done it. And that's the problem, that, you know, you when you take climate action now, because, as I said, we've got all the low-hanging fruit, we're now going for tougher stuff, and we're now going for more costly things in some cases, it's not easy. If it was easy, it would have happened already, but it hasn't happened. And so this is where, you know, huge care needs to be taken, and that requires a level of planning and thought and attention that, you know, I think it can be done. You know, the Biden administration is showing one way of doing it with their Inflation Reduction Act. They're a big, rich country that's had the resources to do that. I think it's much harder in a more financially constrained country like the UK, and then harder still in others. So I'm not, you know, I understand to a point why governments do or say what they do say about what some have said about rolling back some net zero policies. I just think that when you step back and think, you know, where does this get us ultimately?
Longer term.
Right. You know, short term, maybe it might make a bit of sense, but doesn't it make sense to try to push through this, because the alternative is really worrying to contemplate.
And it would be a pity, wouldn't it, to lose that kind of lead that we've taken of, you know, different parties working together and for it to be going the other way.
Yeah, I do think that's the case. You know, the UK has made extraordinary advances and progress in things that aren't really sort of widely understood. For a long time, the UK had more offshore wind power than the rest of the world combined. And most people don't really understand that. Right now, climate tech, you know, climate startups, green energy and green startups are attracting more investment in London than in almost any other city. You know, it's incredible. Yeah, I know. I didn't know that until recently, just how big the whole clean tech sector was here. It's doing incredibly well. And it's a great success story. You know, a lot of people count Octopus Energy as a climate tech company. I'm not sure that Octopus itself would necessarily describe itself like that. But nonetheless, it's a company started by a tech leader that sells green energy. You know, they currently have 6,000 employees just in the UK, another 1,000 internationally. And they didn't even exist in 2015. You know, these are fantastic success stories. And you think, okay, they're kind of, this is happening despite the government at the moment. And what would happen if you had a government that was really wholeheartedly backing the net zero agenda? I kind of can't help but think that it would embolden the hand and strengthen the hand of those who wanted to invest more and really push the climate action agenda along faster.
And so arguably the government should actually be engaging with businesses, the third sector as well, to encourage a conversation about this, and presumably there's not enough of that happening.
Do you know, I think it is happening behind the scenes. So another interesting thing about the UK is that we're one of the few countries that has the equivalent of a green CBI, you know, a Green Business Alliance, which is the Aldersgate group that has been going for many years. And I was talking to the head of the group the other day, and she was making the point that behind the scenes, there's actually a lot of really brilliant climate work going on, and civil servants and officials are having really meaningful and important discussions, conversations all the time with businesses that are trying to pursue a net zero agenda. And she said, you know, it's going on. It's not as if it's disappeared. It's just that all the headlines go to Mr. Sunak saying that he's going to roll back electric
cars.
And unfortunately, some of the people who read those headlines are investors, you know, and most of us, most people just look at the headlines, and some of those people are investors. So, you know, it's, you can't say it's not meaningful. It is meaningful, unfortunately. It just injects a level of uncertainty and confusion about what the UK's ultimate strategy is. Mm. And so, yeah, I don't think we should get too depressed. You know, there is still a lot of good work going on. You look at the climate tech sector, and it's still doing incredibly well. It's not as if this stuff stops or has stopped, and not as if it will stop. It's just annoying, particularly at a time when you're seeing the US and the EU ramp up their green industrial policy. And you know that the UK was ahead of the game, and you just think, can't we just kind of, you know, do we have to really sort of take our foot off the accelerator right now?
Yeah. And actually, as you said, plenty still happening behind the scenes, but it's just not getting out there. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, look, I'm sure if there was a government minister sitting with us now, they'd say, hang on, you know, look at all the work that we are doing. We are promoting offshore wind. We're promoting hydrogen. We're promoting carbon capture, which is, you know, somewhat more contentious than some other technologies. But nonetheless, you know, they'd say, you know, it's not as if we're not doing this, and it's not as if we're not talking about this. The problem, I think, is though, is when the Prime Minister speaks about it, that's the voice that people really listen to. And unfortunately, it's all his ministers, his colleagues might be talking a lot about offshore wind and grid reforms and so on, which is great. But when the Prime Minister's message is that this stuff is expensive and don't worry, we're going to protect you from all of this green expense, that's when it gets tricky.
And as you said, confusing, you know, because hang on a minute, the tone from the top is saying this, but actually behind the scenes you're doing this. Where do we stand? And on such massive topics and important topics, clarity of direction of travel and aim is really important, isn't it? And so, you know, the headline saying something different is very unhelpful.
I think it is. I mean, I don't want to pretend that this stuff is easy. It really isn't. You know, the world has never tried to shift away from the dominant fuel in the global energy system at pace before. It's never been tried. It's never been done, except sort of, I guess, you know, you could say very briefly in times of real disaster, like world wars, the pandemic. Obviously, we saw huge shifts in energy use, as in, you know, not much of it, but for terrible reasons. But this is stuff that in peacetime has never been attempted before. Also, it's not as if we can see a huge global aggressor or a sort of a massive meteorite sort of bearing down on us. You know, it's not as if the climate problem is something that is absolutely manifest every single day in everybody's life. So, it's a tricky, it's not for nothing do they call it a wicked problem, but I think fundamentally anybody who reads any of the UN climate science reports understands how urgently we do need to cut emissions, and there's no escaping that.
And if so, we have various sectors that our clients are in, covering property, creative media and tech, hospitality, financial services, and a whole host of not-for-profit organisations, independent schools, professional institute membership bodies. For any of those who are listening to this and thinking, you know, we have sustainability on our agenda, but not knowing where to start in kind of incorporating that into their strategy, where would you recommend is a good kind of place to start for an organisation, an SME type of organisation in the UK?
Yeah, I think that's a terrific question, because so many organisations know that they need to do something, want to do something, aren't quite sure where to turn. There are groups like the Carbon Trust, which are effectively advisory consultancy groups that specifically exist to help companies take the first steps that need to be taken. And as Bina was saying in our discussion, you know, the very first thing you've got to do is to figure out where your carbon emissions are coming from, how big they are. That's, you know, before you start thinking about what you can do to cut them, figure out what they actually are. And also now, you know, we've been talking obviously about climate change, but more and more people are realizing that the pressure on nature, on biodiversity, is really enormous. And it's we do need to focus on temperatures, but we also need to focus on the fact that we are destroying the natural world at a pace that has never happened before. And we've got species going extinct and woodlands being lost at a terrible rate. And so more and more companies need to understand their impact on the natural world simultaneously, actually, I would say now. So the Carbon Trust, groups like that, can be incredibly helpful as a first start. There are also smaller versions of the Carbon Trust, non-profit groups that have started up to help SMEs, to help smaller businesses to take that first step of trying to figure out how to measure emissions. There's a new universe of companies springing up that claim to be able to help you using AI sometimes, or but certainly technology of various sorts to do this. To be honest, I've not really looked at them closely enough to know which ones I could recommend. But this is a rapidly expanding world. I think just because of the history of the Carbon Trust, which was kind of set up as a quango, as a semi-government organisation, is full of, you know, some really great people, including Chris Stark, the head of the Climate Change Committee, which is the official government watchdog. He's going to be the new chief executive of the Carbon Trust. He's really interesting. I think he, you know, he's so aware of what needs to be done and what the business imperatives are. I think the trust would be a, you know, it's not a bad place to start, but there are other organizations that also exist to help companies take that first step of figuring out really what their carbon footprint is and then trying to think about what they can do about it. But I think that first step is just figuring out what it looks like, what your carbon
measuring it. For any businesses that maybe haven't quite got to this or prioritized it enough as something that they need to be thinking about, is there a risk in not doing that for that business?
Do you know, there is a risk for some businesses, I would say, that has kind of taken me a bit by surprise. I was talking to some people who are involved in making video ads, who are involved in actually shooting the film, but they were saying that they're actually finding it really difficult to find freelance people who'll come in, because the industry often depends on freelance camera people and audio and video people. They're finding it really difficult to find people who'll come in and work on advertisements for big oil and gas companies, because I guess people have the choice of what they work on in that world, and they just don't want to do it anymore. And it made me think, gosh, you know, that's interesting, because when you saw employees of, say, I think Amazon, this has happened, and a number of other big multinationals based in the US, when you started to see a few of them saying, you know, we want our company to do more, I thought that was a bit of a interesting, maybe a bit of a one-off, not something that was going to take off. But then actually, having since then seen lawyers, accountants, all sorts of sectors have suddenly found that their younger employees are really pushing them to take more action. I think that's one risk that companies face if they totally ignore the threat of climate change. They'll find that their own employees will be kind of voting with their feet if they can, or being less enthusiastic about the leadership of the company at least as well. You know, not to overplay that, but I think that's a problem. But then there are the other big problems for any sector here is, I think that research that we started talking about right at the start of this conversation, showing how much consumer and ordinary citizen concern there was about climate change, means that, you know, this is not going to go away. When one way or another, whether politicians are able to tackle adequately or not, and whether climate tech is able to and whatever, one way or another, you know, we're going to reach a point where either emissions stop and the only way to do that is by taking action that hasn't been taken yet, or they keep going, which means that you have a physical threat that we've not seen yet. Either way, there's going to be change, and you have to be ready for that change. There is going to be climate disruption, whether we like it or not. And if you're not prepared for that, then I think that's a risk that, you know, you'd be wise to be knowledgeable about, and you'd be wise to be onto and thinking about.
And those are some very good reasons to put this on the agenda, businesses out there. Helita, thank you very much. You have left us with a clear call for action and actually the hope that we can all make a difference, actually the importance of collaboration, the importance of speaking to people out there in the industry. As you said, there's lots of new organisations now and innovation, lots of new ideas. So it's engaging with those to kind of broaden our knowledge of it as well. And it's been great having a chat with you. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much, Tesh. It's been great to talk to you as well.
And thank you all. Hope you enjoyed the conversation and watch this space for our next topic in the Triple Bottom Line series.